This is Gulf Coast Live from WGCU News. I'm John Davis. Later in the show, host Julie Glenn will be in to discuss the acquisition of Edison Farms by Lee County for use as Conservation 2020 land. And we'll hear about hurricane recovery efforts in Bonita Springs, an area authorities say will directly benefit from keeping that land undeveloped. But first, the Laboratory Theater of Florida in Fort Myers is currently showcasing performances of the play Sordid Lives by playwright Del Shores. The semi-autobiographical LGBT cult classic is a black comedy about family members dealing with their demons as they gather together after the death of a family matriarch. Following tonight's performance, audience members are invited to stick around for a talk back panel discussion to further explore themes in the play, which include grappling with an LGBT identity, gay conversion therapy, and institutionalization. Ahead of tonight's performance, we're joined today by actors in the play, as well as panel members for tonight's post-show talkback discussion. Joining me in studio is Annette Trosbach. She's founder and artistic director of the Laboratory Theater of Florida. Welcome back to the show.
Howdy, John.
And we're also joined in studio by actor Ken Johnson, who plays the colorful character Brother Boy in the Laboratory Theater's production of Sordid Lives. Ken's performances in that show has been lauded as award-worthy by Southwest Florida arts writer Tom Hall. Ken's work with the Laboratory Theater follows a 25-year professional acting career, including numerous roles and performances at the Broadway Palm Dinner Theater here in Fort Myers. Ken Johnson, thanks for being with us.
I'm glad to be here, John.
We're also speaking with Southwest Florida actor Ken Ruisi, who is also featured in the Laboratory Theater's production of Sordid Lives. He's also performed with Theater Conspiracy at the Alliance for the Arts here in Southwest Florida. Ken Ruisi, we'll have him on in just a moment. We're getting in touch with him. But Dr. Derek DeWitt joins us now as well. He's medical director of the McGregor Clinic in Fort Myers and has also participated in past talkback panel discussions at the Laboratory Theater. Dr. DeWitt, great to speak with you again. Oh, and joining us by phone from Tallahassee is Scott McCoy. He's senior policy counsel and acting managing attorney for Florida with the Southern Poverty Law Center. Scott McCoy, thanks for being with us.
I'm happy to be here. Thank you very much for having me.
And I invite listeners to join the conversation as well. Phone lines are open at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. Send your comments and questions on Facebook. We're at WGCU Public Media. Or join the conversation on Twitter. We're at WGCU. Use the hashtag GCL. And Annette, to get started, can you give us just a brief synopsis of the play, Sordid Lives, and maybe some of the themes you're looking to highlight with tonight's post-show talkback panel discussion?
Sure. Playwright Del Shores refers to the show as a black comedy about white trash. And the synopsis is, chaos erupts in Winters, Texas, when Peggy, a good Christian woman, trips over her lover's wooden legs on her way to the bathroom, hits her head on the sink, and dies. That's how the show begins. And that's what moves the action forward. And the genius of Del Shores is that he presents some very heavy themes with comedy and a lot of heart. So we'll talk about those themes, including adultery and addiction, as well as gay conversion therapy.
All right. And can you tell me a bit about the selection process? How did you, come to say, this is a play Fort Myers needs?
It was brought to me by Scott Carpenter, who's the director, maybe 3 or 4 years ago. And I looked at it and thought, I don't know how we can stage this. And that was a mistake on my part. So I really need to read scripts with a set designer and make sure that we can do them. So it's been back and forth in our play selection committee for several years now. And he approached me again in March and we talked about it. So it was thanks to Scott that we were able to do it.
All right. And, the Laboratory Theater's developed a bit of a reputation for selecting plays wouldn't necessarily characterize as safe. You don't really shy away from contemporary productions and really plays that tackle some sometimes controversial or uncomfortable themes and social issues.
Mm-hmm.
Is this intentional?
I think that theaters and artists generally are the askers of questions, and sometimes those questions are uncomfortable. And I think part of our job is to hold that magnifying glass up to our society, our lives, our culture, and to also seek to, as actors, we seek to step into the shoes of people whose lives and whose truths are very different to ours. So sometimes it's controversial and sometimes it isn't. But I think the more that we talk about uncomfortable or hidden or taboo topics, the less uncomfortable and taboo and hidden they are.
Right, right. And, you know, as far as the post-show talkback panel discussion mm-hmm. tonight, this is not a first for the Laboratory Theater. What kind of gave you the idea of doing this and, you know, giving audience members kind of more of an opportunity to maybe ask questions or explore themes that maybe in another setting they wouldn't feel as comfortable doing?
I think you just answered your own question. I mean, you know, we've been doing it for years. So we do maybe 5 or 6 of these every season. And every show obviously has different themes. And we'd like to invite community members in who have direct interaction with the people involved in these themes or who have immediate knowledge that they can share. So that this is just another one of those talkbacks. And we have a great panel set up for tonight.
Yeah, looking forward to that.
Yeah.
Ken Johnson, tell us a little bit about your character. Quite a colorful character.
Well, it is. Scott Carpenter is the one that got me to look at the script and look at the TV, but the movie version of it. And I did. And to me, the character that stood out was Brother Boy. And Brother Boy is a Tammy Wynette-obsessed homosexual transvestite who got beat up when he was in his 20s. And his mother said, well, that just proves my point. He can't live in regular society like a normal human being. It's too dangerous. So they took him the next day to the Big Springs Mental Institution. And we find him in the play 23 years later at about 48 or 49 trying to be de-homosexualized. When I decided that I was really interested in this, I'd only played a drag part once. I'd been in La Cage aux Folles, mm-hmm. and that was years ago, and I hadn't done anything like that since. Well, I thought, well, if I'm going to do this, to get him to really consider me, I'm going to have to come to the audition dressed in drag. So I spent 2 weeks getting everything it said in the script that he wears and got it all down to a T and stuff, and then came to the audition in drag, in full makeup and everything. And I ended up getting the part, and I was really happy because this is it's a revelation, this little part is. And he's just one part of a much bigger play.
Right, right. Yeah, yeah. And you know, this is like a larger-than-life character here. But, I mean, when you're reading the script, when you're getting yourself into this role, are there things in your real life, your personal life, that kind of resonate in terms of this character?
Absolutely. The whole thing about how you know, we as gay people, I'm gay myself, and how we are seen by society, you know, I grew up and even my parents, you know, had a hard time to deal with this to begin with, you know. It took a long time. But I've been in a relationship now for 17 years, and my mom really loves my partner very much, you know. So Brother Boy has a lot of heart. And he's been in this institution for 23 years, and being institutionalized that long, it's hard to keep any kind of hope. All right, and he's been able to do that. And in the play, you get to find out whether he gets out to go to the mother's funeral. And his mother, he has a love-hate relationship with his mother.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Which I don't have with my mom. I love her to death.
Right.
And we have a great cast. Our cast is just fantastic. And they all approach their characters, making them true characters, not just characters, caricatures.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So that's good.
Well, and on that topic of fellow cast members, we have Ken Ruisi joining us by phone. Tell us a bit about the character you play.
Ken's not in the show.
Hmm. Oh, okay.
Ken Johnson's in the show. Ken Ruisi was calling in because, you know, of some of his history.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, Ken is an actor as well.
Yes,
I thought there
he
was
is.
A little confusion there because
okay.
I couldn't find anything about his character, and that's why. Ken Ruisi, can you maybe tell us a bit about your experience as it relates to the, you know, one of the central themes of this play, which is conversion therapy?
Well, some of the things that Ken Johnson has said apply to me, except when I was institutionalized in a state hospital, it wasn't called conversion therapy. I did have therapy. I spent 9 months in a state hospital, and I was under 21, and a friend of mine signed me out, but he had to let me go back in for another 3 months because he was on parole, and his parole officer found out that I had homosexual tendencies. I was still closeted, but I was a nervous wreck about it. This was before the Summer of Love. It was in 1962.
Wow. I think it's, you know, maybe important for people to remember how different the experience of being gay was. You know, now we live in this, you know, post It Gets Better project era.
Where,
you know,
kids are coming right. out in high school and mm-hmm. even as low as elementary school or middle school.
Right, right.
It's a whole different ballgame.
can you maybe tell us, Ken, a little more about your experience of being institutionalized? What did your, you know, therapy, and I'm using air quotes here, actually involve?
It was mostly non-related. It was a taboo subject, and it was mostly occupational therapy and recreational therapy, and doing time.
Yeah.
My mother came in and signed me up for electroshock therapy, but that didn't work out because the first one almost killed me, and jeez. They discontinued that. That was supposed to help me forget about my past, not to straighten me out, as far as I knew.
And is what you experienced back then, was that common for, you know, gay or lesbian identified people?
I really couldn't tell you that because I didn't relate to other patients at that level. Like as I said, it was a taboo subject, and I'm sure there were others who weren't straight, but I wouldn't have known.
Right. You know, and looking back, how do you think that experience, you know, impacted or shaped your own self perception and identity?
Hmm. Well, when the Laboratory Theater put on One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, I was cast in a role that was a patient, and I was very reluctant to do it, and I was pretty nervous through all that, but it's made me shy and alone, and
But Ken's a great guy. He's an absolutely great guy. I think he's one of my favorite people. I'm always happy to see Ken because he really is happy. You're happy most of the time, I think, aren't you, nowadays?
Yeah. Most of the time, yeah. At least one of everybody's, at least one good friends of mine like you see me.
Yeah, that's good.
Excellent. Well, we're exploring some of the sometimes difficult themes of LGBT identity and conversion therapy in the Laboratory Theater's currently running production of the play Sordid Lives. Listeners can join our conversation by calling 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. Send us your comments and questions on Facebook. We're at WGCU Public Media. Or join the conversation on Twitter. We're at WGCU. Use the hashtag GCL. And I was hoping we could also maybe just explore a bit about what, you know, conversion therapy actually is. And to be clear, this is a pseudoscientific practice. It's really not endorsed by legitimate medical organizations like the American Psychiatric Association, mm-hmm. Which has characterized the practice as unethical and potentially harmful. Mm-hmm. Dr. Derek DeWitt is with the McGregor Clinic, and Scott McCoy is with the Southern Poverty Law Center. I was hoping, starting with Dr. DeWitt, maybe you could tell us a bit more about the approach of conversion therapy techniques and what the practice actually consists of. It looks like we don't have a – we lost Dr. DeWitt, but maybe Scott McCoy, is this something that comes up in your work with the Southern Poverty Law Center?
Absolutely, and John, not to push back in a bad way, but I would say you had mentioned that this is a scientific technique. I would actually maybe contest that and suggest that it is actually an unscientific technique. The techniques that
I meant to say pseudoscientific, not supported
by science, but I don't think that's what you meant. I think what you meant was they do involve psychological counseling, if you will, and exercises and whatnot. And in today's world, conversion therapy oftentimes consists of what you would popularly know as talk therapy. The days of electroshock therapy and lobotomy and those kind of things, fortunately, are in the past, and those practices have been cast aside. But the practices in the talk therapy and some of the more bizarre psychodrama activities and things like that are still used and are still as psychologically harmful to LGBT people as some of those other more invasive physical treatments.
Right. And is this something that comes up with your work with the Southern Poverty Law Center or perhaps with other attorneys with the SPLC, if not you personally?
Yeah, actually it does, and it is something that I have personally worked on. So the Southern Poverty Law Center has an LGBT rights project, and it's a group of litigators that work to protect LGBT rights for people, in the South in particular, but also all over the country. And I actually personally worked on a lawsuit that we brought on behalf of four gay men and two of their mothers in New Jersey. And the men and the mothers in that case sued conversion therapists in New Jersey, claiming that the conversion therapy that they were provided basically amounted to consumer fraud. Because the basic premise of conversion therapy is that homosexuality is a mental disease or disorder or a defect of some kind. And that they can, by doing some psychological, trickery, basically cure you or fix you, and change your sexual orientation from one that is homosexual to heterosexual. And all of those things that I just said are the representations that conversion therapists make, and they're all false. And so we were able to show a jury in New Jersey that conversion therapy is both bogus, untrue, and also harmful. And so the jury unanimously found that it was fraudulent and that it was an unconscionable business practice. That was the first case of its kind in the country, and we learned a great deal about, where conversion therapy is happening, who's doing it, and how it's done. So it is something that we continually work on. And even here in the state of Florida, we work, over the last several months, we've been working with groups in various parts of the state to have municipalities, like cities, and then counties, pass ordinances that ban the practice of conversion therapy for minors. And so, like right now, Miami-Dade County has an ordinance that it's considering, and Palm Beach County has one, and Tampa has passed one. So that work continues, and that's something that I work on a daily basis as well.
Right, right.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, despite the, the known risks of this practice and the growing social acceptance of the LGBT community, nationwide, only 9 states in the U.S. and the District of Columbia actually have laws prohibiting the practice of conversion therapy on minors. Florida is, as you just told us, is among the 41 states that have no such ban in place statewide.
Correct.
How would you characterize the practice today? Is it fairly widespread? Because it's not necessarily something you just read in the headlines unless you specifically go looking for it.
Right, and I think that's good news, because I think as a light has been shown on the practice, it has been driven underground in some respects, and so it is definitely not in favor as it was. I mean, it was kind of, there was a big kind of movement in the 90s that popularized it. But fortunately, through our work and other work, that has been diminishing greatly. And so there are many fewer conversion therapists out there, you know, operating kind of very overtly. Many of them have kind of been driven more underground, and it's more kind of word of mouth to find them. And so that is a challenge, but it's also, I think, a sign of a little bit of a victory that we've been able to really diminish their existence. I will say, though, that there are organizations in Florida that are engaging in conversion therapy and therapists who still do it, and that's one of the reasons why you see these municipalities and counties taking up the banner of banning this practice, because the legislature is refusing to do so. Unfortunately, there are a number of them still operating. The other thing that's also difficult is many of them, you know, can do this therapy via, like, Skype or over the phone. So even though you may not have, you know, some of the most notorious conversion therapists are, you know, in Texas or in California, but you still have, you know, potentially kids from Florida and other states who are, you know, being subjected to these practices, but in a virtual setting. And that's also a particularly difficult thing to, you know, kind of get at, because in the world of modern technology, this is starting to cross state lines as well.
Right. Annette, you wanted to jump in here?
Yeah, Scott, I was just wondering, you mentioned conversion therapists are being driven underground recently. I was wondering, are these licensed therapists, or how are they able to call themselves therapists if they are not if they're not licensed therapists or medical practitioners?
Yeah, that's a really great question, and I would say there I kind of like to think of it as there are three types of conversion therapists, if you will. The first type is the kind of a therapist that has, you know, the letters after their name. They are a doctor, they have a PhD or an MD or something like that, and they have a license. So they've gone to the state and they hold themselves out under a license. That type of conversion therapist is becoming the rarest, because as the national organizations and states are clearly saying that conversion therapy is bad and it's an unprofessional practice, those therapists are just basically saying, you know, I'm not going to risk my license over doing this, and so I'm not going to do it. So increasingly, that group of conversion therapists is shrinking greatly, and that's great. The next set of conversion therapists are people who may have some kind of training or education. For instance, they might have a master's degree in social work, or they might have a professional counselor's degree from somewhere, but they haven't gone out and they haven't actually gotten a license from the state, and they kind of operate in a gray area where they call themselves often life coaches, and these life coaches then are engaging in these different techniques and things which I think arguably could qualify as the practice of you know, counseling, but they operate in this margin. And then the third kind is, say, maybe a religious leader or a pastor or a rabbi or something who doesn't have any training or anything and is just giving pastoral counseling and is saying, you know, you shouldn't be gay because it's against the religious beliefs of our you know, religion, and, you know, that kind of a thing. So those are the three kind of types. And so we've been very successful, I think, on the license side. And we're trying to, like, you know, go after the quote-unquote life coaches. Like, in our case in New Jersey, the conversion therapists that we sued were not licensed. They were people that had some training, but they operated as life coaches. Mm-hmm. And the reason we were able to get at them with the conversion, with the consumer fraud theory, is because they were holding themselves out and offering services for money. And so we were able to use that kind of consumer fraud angle to get at them. So I hope that is a helpful explanation.
Yes, thank you. And Dr. Derek DeWitt with the McGregor Clinic has been standing by patiently. I wanted to bring you into the conversation here. We heard a bit from Ken Ruisi about his personal experience that involved a life-threatening electroshock therapy treatment. And I understand that you participated in this as well at an earlier point in your life when you were in med school.
Right. It was about 10 years ago. It wasn't as drastic as that, but I was really struggling because I grew up in a religious household, so I was really struggling with my sexual orientation and reconciling that with my religious beliefs. And so I was very depressed and almost suicidal, and I didn't know what to do. I asked for help from church leaders, and they referred me to a counselor who specialized in sexual, like, I guess you could say conversion. And, you know, it was cognitive behavioral therapy that I went to once a week for about 6 months, you know, to try to change the way I was thinking, which would, you know, hopefully in turn change my behavior. And it was, you know.
What changed your mind? What eventually enabled you to leave that behind?
Well, I mean, I wasn't really getting any less depressed. And some of the, you know, what they were telling me was that the problem was that I had a lack of male, like strong male role models in my life. And so I needed to establish strong male presences in my life that were non-sexual. And by doing that, it wasn't really working for me in that way, because it was still like a sexual component to it. So I just, and I in turn just kind of stopped going to church, and I became less depressed. And, you know, over time, my sexual orientation became more of a comfortable thing for me, and the depression kind of went away as the religion went away.
Derek, can I piggyback on that? I was chatting with a local therapist, Dr. Laura Strayfeller, who was not able to join us today, but she was saying she works with a lot of gay and transgender people in the area, and she said conversion therapy is so harmful because it's not teaching anyone to heal, but instead causing self-hatred and internalized homophobia. And it sounds like that's exactly what you were experiencing.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, I some of the things that I was taught there, I took with a grain of salt, because my church was, you know, marriage between a man and a woman was very important. And that's, you know, kind of their end goal, was that I would be attracted to women and marry a woman. And I never thought that I would ever be able to do that, because it would just not be fair. And so, you know, even if I could change the way I was thinking, I wasn't going to go fully in the way that they would want me to go in that sense. But, you know, it took me a long time to recover from that depression. But, yeah, so I think in that sense it was harmful to me.
And, of course, now you're, you know, treating patients at the McGregor Clinic. You're a physician. Is this something that comes up in your practice? Is this something that, you know, patients have spoken to you about?
Oh, yeah, it definitely does. And, I mean, part of the reason that I got into this is because I don't want anyone to ever feel the way that I felt at that time. But I've had people that, you know, I have one patient that he told me that I was the first person that he ever told that he was gay, and he was in his 50s or 60s. And so there's still some stigma associated with it. A lot of it is just from people that come from religious backgrounds.
Mm-hmm. Right. And, you know, I wanted to go back to Scott McCoy for a moment here, just to get a little more update on the legislative angle here. You know, we talked about Florida not having any kind of statewide ban on this practice when it comes to minors. State Representative David Richardson, I know at least a couple times, has tried to pass a bill that would do just that. This year's bill died in committee. Is he someone you stay in touch with? Do you know if he's likely to try and file that bill again in the 2018 legislative session, which is going to kick off in January?
Yeah, actually, I've worked very closely with Representative Richardson, and also in the Senate, there is a Senator Clemens also introduces the companion bill. I haven't talked to him this year to know whether he's going to file that, but I would be surprised if he did not. I suspect that he will. I think it's an issue that he has focused on, and it's still an important issue, so I would not be surprised at all. Having said that, however, obviously the track record of that bill is not great. And I think that's one of the things, because the state legislature is unwilling to address the problem, I think that's why you see municipalities and counties taking, you know, the matter into their own hands and doing what they can do to try to protect the LGBT populations in their, you know, jurisdictions. And for that, they should be commended. It's kind of the same thing, you know, if you remember what happened with the non-discrimination ordinances. Like, you know, the state of Florida does not include sexual orientation or gender identity in its employment, you know, and housing non-discrimination law for the state. But you know, because the legislature wouldn't include it, many jurisdictions across the state of Florida have enacted their own local ordinances to help, you know, fight that kind of discrimination. And we're seeing the same thing happen with the conversion therapy issue.
Gotcha. Well, that is all the time we have for this portion of the program, so we'll have to leave it there. But thanks so much to my guests, Annette Trosbach, founder and artistic director of the Laboratory Theater of Florida here in
Thank
Fort Myers.
Thank you so much.
Actor Ken Johnson, thanks for being in studio with us.
Thanks. We got 5 shows this weekend, so come on out.
Oh, yes. Also, thanks to actor Ken Ruisi for joining us today as well. We've also been speaking with Dr. Derek DeWitt from the McGregor Clinic in Fort Myers, and also thanks to Scott McCoy with the Southern Poverty Law Center. Audiences at tonight's performance of Sorted Lives at the Laboratory Theater in Fort Myers are invited to stick around for the show afterwards for a talkback panel discussion about some of those difficult themes in the play we've been discussing today. Tonight's show starts at 8 o'clock. The show will also run this Friday and Saturday night at 8. There's going to be an additional matinee performance Saturday afternoon at 2. Am I missing any?
Sunday at 2.
And Sunday at 2.
Thank you.
We're taking a short break, but when we return, Lee County commissioners agreed last week to spend more than $42 million to buy the property known as Edison Farms and protect it under the county's Conservation 2020 plan. But in the wake of Hurricane Irma, even those who support the purchase say they have questions. WGCU's Julie Glenn talks with the Conservancy of Southwest Florida about their concerns and the future of Edison Farms. I'm John Davis, and this is Gulf Coast Live. Stay with us.